tres, cuatro.
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Cott. 40 years after its release, Neil Young's masterpiece, Rust Never Sleeps, still captivates listeners and critics with its simple melodies, complex lyrics, and punk-inspired sound.
We'll discuss the album's impact and how Neil Young's blend of acoustic and electric instruments made for an iconic musical experience.
That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now that it is July, we're in the heart of summer vacation. Greg, as you and many of our listeners know, when I am not here hosting Sound Opinions, I'm a professor at Columbia College in Chicago, so I know the importance of keeping your brain engaged, even when school is not in session. Over the summer, we're going to have a few episodes revisiting our discussions about some albums that we think are extremely important, canonic, if you will. We're calling this Sound Opinions Summer School, and class starts today.
That's right, Professor DeRogatis, and we're starting with an album dissection of Neil Young and Crazy Horse's Rust Never Sleeps, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this summer.
What you're hearing is the first track from that record, My My Hey Hey Out of the Blue, the acoustic version of the song that actually frames the album. Neil Young does an acoustic version up top, closes with the electric version. It really tells the story of this record.
The album came out in 1979. It was one of dozens of albums that Neil Young has released over his career. Jim, you and I immediately lasered in on this record when we talked about, let's do a dissection of one of Neil Young's records. Both of us said, Rust Never Sleeps is the one. I don't know about you, but I think for me, this album represented a key point in an artist's career where he had to make a decision. He could go one way or another, the proverbial fork in the road.
Yeah.
He was the first of that 60s generation of artists who had made a lot of bread in the 60s and had come to a lot of fame and had a fairly successful 70s, albeit in a checkered fashion. He was up and down, but he was still selling lots of records. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, that name was iconic. He could tour with those guys anytime and do stadium tours. And all of a sudden, something happened. 76, 77. Remember the summer of hate in England. Punk rock comes along. And how would these vintage rockers respond? Well, Neil Young's response, above all others, I think, was unique. He was the one guy that got it, and this was the album that said, not only do I get it, but I'm going to trump all of you. I'm going to trump my peers, and I'm going to go toe-to-toe with the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and show you how it's done.
Well, you have to remember the context. You know, you have the Rolling Stones suddenly realizing we better up our game. All these punks are making us look old. Here's Some Girls. And, you know, you have Yes giving you Going for the One and bands like that. Everybody's stripping down and wondering what it's about. But Young had gone over to England in the middle of 1977. There is a phenomenal article that Cameron Crowe wrote in 1979 for Rolling Stone called Neil Young, the Last American Hero. And Young tells Cameron here, I first knew something was going on when we visited England a year and a half ago. Kids were tired of the rock stars and the limousines and the abusing of stage privileges as stars. There was this new music the kids were listening to. As soon as I heard my contemporaries saying, God, what is this? This is going to be over in 3 months. I knew it was a sure sign right there that they were going to bite it if they didn't watch out. A lot of them are biting it this year. People are not going to come back and see the same thing over and over again. It's got to change. It's the snake that eats itself. Punk music, new wave, call it what you want. It's rock and roll to me, and it's still the basis of what's going on. And it has been the basis of Young's entire career, whether he's been in acoustic mode, whether he's been in electric mode, whether he's been playing with synthesizers. You know, he has always been about evolving and moving forward. And there's kind of a funny story about the album that preceded Russ Never Sleeps, Comes a Time, a perfectly fine but not great Neil Young album. He was sick to death of it by the time it came out because he was excited by this new music coming from the Lower East Side of Manhattan and coming from England. He was very excited about this new album, which he proceeds to record mostly live, in large part live, in the Cow Palace in San Francisco. There are some overdubs added, and there's an avalanche of product. There's the album Rust Never Sleeps, which we're focusing on. There's a double live album called Live Rust, comes from the same period and time. And there's a movie called Rust Never Sleeps that's a concert film.
Young's connection with punk was apt, Jim, because one of the key connections, one of the key inspirations for this album was that Ohio art punk band Devo. Circuitous connection made here. There were tapes of early Devo tracks circulating among certain rock intelligentsia. David Bowie had one. Iggy Pop had one. Dean Stockwell, a sort of a hanger-on of that scene, Hollywood actor by day, a rock star by night, had a copy. His girlfriend, Toni Basil, got a copy.
The choreographer turned pop star in the 80s. Yeah.
Which Stockwell had heard. Stockwell, in turn, gave it to Young. Young was blown away. What is this? I've never heard anything like this. These guys are amazing. So he ends up meeting Mark Mothersbaugh and company from Akron. They come out to San Francisco, and they start working on the tail end of this film, Human Highway, with him. That is a just total chaotic affair. I mean, Dennis Hopper is involved, right? That should tell you something.
Well, as his alter ego, Bernard Shakey, Neil Young has fantasized that he's been a film director throughout his career, and this was one of the periods where he's behind the camera.
Right. So Young is working on this song, Hey, Hey, My, My, Into the Black. And along the way, Devo starts working with him on the song. Young is asking them to perform the song in the movie, and they Devo it up. I mean, they come do this warped version of the song. Along the way, he gets to talking to these guys, and he hears them dropping this line, Rust Never Sleeps. He says, where's that from? These guys used to be in the advertising world in their early days back in Ohio, and this was one of the graphic design elements they used for a rust-proofing company
Rust-Oleum
that they were working
spray
for.
Rust-Oleum spray paint.
Rust Never Sleeps. Young thought that was just brilliant. In some ways, it coalesced the album for him. What is this album about? It is about obsolescence. It's about, is it better to burn out or to fade away? He was facing that very question with his own career. The punks were bringing him to the brink, questioning his real value.
The king is gone, but he's not forgotten. This is the story of Johnny Rotten. It's better to burn out than it is to rust. The king is gone, but he's not forgotten.
It needs to be said that not only in 1977 did we have this explosion of punk in England that Neil Young witnessed firsthand, but also the death of Elvis Presley in August of 77. So somehow, you know, everything, the cosmos was realigning.
Yeah.
The old rock and roll was dying. The new one was coming up. Neil Young was trying to decide, where do I fit in? And with the help of Devo, he developed a theme for this record. Suddenly, Comes a Time didn't sound so cool anymore.
Right.
And suddenly, this new thing that he was working on needed to be done. It needs to be said as well that Young preferred to work backwards. It was not about going into the studio, creating a record, and then going out and touring it. It was about touring the record first,
yeah,
and then making that record. And in this case, taking the live versions of those songs that he played on a 1978 tour, primarily in San Francisco, but also from other sites as well, and recording those songs, draining out the crowd noise, so it was just almost an eerie background effect, and culling those songs and making it this record. Jim, I think it's fascinating that in the context of punk rock, the death of Elvis, etc., he still did a record that in many ways is the best of all Neil Young worlds. It wasn't going to be just one thing. Half acoustic, half electric. Both sides equally profound, but there was a punk ethos about even the acoustic songs on this record.
Yeah, there certainly was, and you can see it in the film. Again, I don't want to dwell on the concert movie, but one of the things that's really important to remember is that the stage props for this tour were giant oversized amplifiers, a giant microphone, okay? And he's on stage in front of this 20-foot microphone and these 40-foot amps, right? What is that about? Young told Cameron Crowe that, "I felt dwarfed by the music industry. The music industry had gotten so big, so bloated, so corporate, so soulless. I didn't know where I fit in anymore." That's Neil Young in 78. I mean, mm-hmm. Think about it today, right? I think it was brave to open with an acoustic set, as you said, and to stand there alone with that acoustic guitar in an arena, which is always a brave move, but in the middle of punk. There are many hardcore heavy metal fans that I grew up with, hipster punk rockers at that time. Everybody loved Neil Young. He would sing Sugar Mountain, and the most hard-ass rock fan would get a tear in his eye, mm-hmm. okay? You had to love him because there was a soul in that music, no matter how he was playing it, whether he was going back to what he always called his best band ever, Crazy Horse. For the thousands of nights they've done on the road, Young has always maintained, "I have never had a bad night when I was playing with Crazy Horse." They were at the top of their game here, but he was at the top of his game acoustically as well, and that's where we're going to pick up after a quick break. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. That is the song Welfare Mothers from Neil Young's 1979 album, Rust Never Sleeps. We're doing a classic album dissection of this record, one that stands out from Young's incredible catalog. You know, throughout his catalog, Greg, I would have to say, whether we're talking about work with Buffalo Springfield, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Young's prolific solo catalog, if we both were put on the spot and had to choose one album we'd take with us to the desert island, it would be Rust Never Sleeps. I got to say, partly too, I think, Greg, it's because we grew up with it. Mm-hmm. This was when we were really cognizant young rock fans. We knew what came before. You had to have Decade. Everybody had Decade, you know, mm-hmm. the ultimate best of in rock history. But we got to see this, and this felt like Neil's gift to us. All those people in the 60s who'd seen him with Buffalo Springfield, who knew him from before, yeah, all well and good. We appreciate the guy's history, but he's making the best music in the world right now, and he's giving it to us. And as I said earlier, he's doing it fearlessly. How uncool in the heyday of the Sex Pistols, of the Clash, of the Ramones, to stand on stage with an acoustic guitar and a harmonica. Mm-hmm. As we said, there's two sides to this record, the acoustic side and the electric side, both bookended by My My Hey Hey Out of the Blue, one acoustic version, one electric version. This is Young saying, these are the two sides of my career, these are the two sides of my personality. You may think it's black and white, but it's not really. The electric side is powered, of course, by Crazy Horse, that wonderful band. Pancho Sampedro, Billy Talbot, Ralph Molina. The acoustic side is basically just Neil, although the great Nicolette Larson lends some backing vocals on the song Sail Away. The acoustic side was kind of a grab bag. The song Sail Away had been recorded without Crazy Horse sometime around the making of Comes a Time. Pocahontas was recorded solo in 1975, so it's not one of those songs that came from the stage of the Cow Palace. Much of the bulk of Rust Never Sleeps was recorded on stage live in front of an audience in San Francisco at the Cow Palace. The audience noise was dubbed out, sometimes better than others. You can hear them during My My Hey Hey. And then there were overdubs added. So Young was taking the basic recordings of the live tracks and then augmenting them. He wanted this to be a studio album. At the same time, he's thinking later about the live album and he's thinking about the movie. What do we have on the acoustic side? Well, My My Hey Hey, Out of the Blue, is, as you said, a requiem for Sid Vicious. It's Out of the Blue and Into the Black. They give you this, but you pay for that. He's thinking about the place of Johnny Rotten. He's thinking about Sid Vicious self-destroying. He's thinking about the way the king of rock and roll died. And he's saying that the Sex Pistols are very much a part of that lineage in the same way that Elvis was. You got to remember how radical punk rock seemed in 76 and 77. People were saying, this is just noise. This is cheap sensationalism. This has nothing to do with the rock and roll I love. Choose one. The Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, Neil Young. Mm. Neil Young saying, I wish I was as good as the Sex Pistols. Mm. And of course he is. He's going to proceed to show us that. The acoustic songs, aside from My My Hey Hey, are very familiar themes for Young. He loves to play with American history, the rich tapestry of American history, and he loves to do weird juxtapositions with it. Ride My Llama. For a while, this album was going to be called Ride My Llama, the silliest Neil Young song title ever. Begins with, Remember the Alamo, when help was on the way. It's better here and now. I feel that good today.
I feel that good today. I like to take a walk, but not around the block. I really got some news. I met a man from Mars. He picked up all my guitars and played me traveling songs.
This is classic Neil Young. He's simultaneously thinking of the great tapestry of American history, but saying, now, live in the moment, seize the moment. It's all about, he feels that good today, all right? You know, and he's going to ride his llama from Peru to Texarkana. I don't know what that's about. It doesn't matter. The best Neil Young lines have never made any sense, but they sound so wonderfully poetic. Sail Away is similar. I could live in a teepee. I could die in Penthouse 33. He's thinking about how he's really a very simple guy, but he's in the midst of this rock stardom, and where does he fit? He's trying to get back to where he fit when he started out playing in garage bands up in Canada. And he's trying to take that road back and reconnect because he's very inspired by what these punks are doing.
I could live inside a teepee. I could die in Penthouse 35. You could lose me on the freeway. I would still make it back alive. As long as we can sail away.
Could there be a more uncool way to start a song in the heyday of punk than the way Young starts Thrasher? They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. When I would walk to CBGB as a 17 and 18-year-old, there weren't no hay bales in New York City. There weren't no hay bales in any punk rock club in America. And yet, I somehow connected with this music Neil Young was singing.
They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. But the light of day was on them. They could see the thrashers coming. And the water shone like diamonds in the dew.
As we look at the acoustic side of Rust Never Sleeps, one track really stands out. It might even be my favorite Young song of all time, Pocahontas. And this one, too, has a very familiar Neil Young theme. You'll recall in Cortez the Killer, he has already fantasized himself as one of the Southern American native peoples who are overwhelmed by the Spanish when they invade, and Cortez the Killer comes and decimates a culture. I think Pocahontas ups the ante even better because Neil Young is so fascinated, this Canadian, with America. And this is one of the great American anthems of all time. It starts by Young contemplating nature, as he often does. He is a stone-cold hippie. He loves to go out and think about how beautiful nature is. Aurora borealis, the icy sky at night. Paddles cut the water in a long and hurried flight. Oh, what's happening? We're looking at this scene, and suddenly there are native peoples in a canoe running away. Running away from what? Running away from incidents like Wounded Knee, where the American expansion through the West drove the native peoples further and further from their homelands into reservations and almost to extinction. They killed us in our teepee. They cut our women down. They might have left some babies crying on the ground. It's like, wow, heavy stuff. what is Neil talking about? He's talking about the soul of America here. And then in that typically surreal fashion, he shifts and takes it to Mars, the same way Ride My Llama. What does Texarkana and the Alamo have to do with Mars when he starts dropping Mars in? Same way here. And this is how he does it. Maybe Marlon Brando will join us by the fire. We'll sit and talk of Hollywood and the good things there for hire. The Astrodome and the first TP, Marlon Brando, Pocahontas, and me. Wow, what's going on? The Godfather, one of the best movies of all time, Marlon Brando won the Oscar. And he refused to go to the Academy Awards ceremonies. In his place, he sent a Native American woman, Sasheen Littlefeather, who accepted his Oscar but gave a speech about the harsh treatment by the American government and the American people of the Native peoples of this country. Brando was always an activist, but of course he's also an American icon. Besides Elvis, who's already appeared on this album, I mean, who else are you going to put on that postage stamp to say, this is America, right? Mm-hmm. It's Marlon Brando. And Young is fantasizing himself sitting around a campfire getting stoned on the peace pipe with Pocahontas, Marlon Brando, Neil Young, thinking about what's great about America, but also what's wrong with it. How can you not love this song to pieces? This is Neil Young's Pocahontas on Sound Opinions.
They killed us in our TV, and they cut our women down. They might have left some babies crying on the ground, but the fire still. Setting sun, massacred the buffalo, kitty corner from the bank, and the taxis run across my feet, and my eyes are turned to blanks in my little box at the top of the stairs.
That is Pocahontas from Neil Young on Sound Opinions from the acoustic half of Rust Never Sleeps. We're doing a classic album dissection of that iconic 1979 Neil Young record. And it is iconic for many reasons, one of which is that classic acoustic side that Jim DeRogatis just addressed, and now the electric side, which I'm going to be looking at. The electric side of the record, Crazy Horse in its full glory. Crazy Horse, the band that Neil had been playing with for much of the 70s, Frank, Pancho Sampedro, Billy Talbot, Ralph Molina, they are in their glory on this side of the record. As we've said, the song that starts out acoustic, My My, Hey Hey, Out of the Blue, frames the record. The band flips it on the electric side. It becomes electric, it becomes Hey Hey, My My, Into the Black. Nothing like this sound was being made in 1979, and I say this with all due respect to all the punks that were out there. I swear, Jim, when I put this record on, I thought it was defective, especially the electric side. It was so loud, so distorted, I'm going, wow, he's punching you in the face. And it was especially true of that last track on side two, Hey Hey, My My, Into the Black, electric version. Billy Talbot, the bass player, once told me one of the things that was sort of floating around at the time was that Queen song, We Will Rock You, and Neil was kind of like, I'm going to one-up that. You think that was heavy? I'm going to stomp you into the ground. So that Brontosaurus stomp on this song was very apt. When Neil was touring this record, he was playing it to some pretty highfalutin audiences. I mean, the Hollywood stars would come out to see the tour wherever it was because it was being billed as this elaborate theatrical kind of thing. There's a great story going around that Ahmet Erdogan, one of his closest friends in the record business. Founder of Atlantic Records. Man had worked with him since the days of Buffalo Springfield in the 60s. Came to one of the shows, I believe it was a show in San Francisco, and left after two songs of the electric portion of the show because it was too loud. And Young wanted it to be loud. He wanted it to be ear-splitting. He wanted it to be challenging for the audience. So Crazy Horse was gathered around the drum riser and playing their butts off. They were playing as loud as they possibly could, playing this ferocious, violent music. We get some examples of it on this record. Sedan Delivery, Welfare Mothers precede Hey Hey My My into the Black, and they are just stomping versions of what this band could do. Welfare Mothers, kind of tongue-in-cheek, obviously just a series of chants. Sedan Delivery, more complicated, one of those long, winding Young narratives, kind of creepy. The guy's looking for a job. Unemployment's in the air. Is he delivering drugs? What exactly is this man doing?
Well, and it's like on 45 RPM.
Exactly. It's a ferocious example of sonics trumping sense.
Last night I was cool at the pool hall. Held the table for 11 games. I think it was easier than the first seven. I beat a woman with varicose veins. She stopped to see herself in the mirror. Fix her hair and hide her veins. And she lost the game.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and we are dissecting Neil Young's classic album, Rust Never Sleeps. Greg, what do you think of Neil commenting on the anti-welfare sentiment at the time, in the song Welfare Mothers, with that line, "Welfare mothers make better lovers," followed by the chants of divorcee?
I think there's no doubt that there's certain empathy for the blue collar class. He comes from that. He's empathizing with it here. I think it's tongue in cheek. It's obviously meant to make you chuckle a little bit, but clearly that was in the air at the time. Unemployment was rising. The country's economy was in the toilet. I think he was feeling some of that. And yes, he was making a statement here. These are people too, much like the Native Americans.
Yeah.
He was talking about America as well. And one of the things that strikes me about this album, Jim, is that the lens is a little wider here. He'd been making very personal records immediately preceding this. Comes a Time was a great example of kind of a personal, romantic kind of record. Even Tonight's the Night was about his personal travails, the wreckage of the mid-70s and that band falling apart.
The people he lost to drug abuse.
Here he's pulling it back, and it's a much wider screen look at America and its place in the world, and, by extension, his place in the world. He was questioning his own place because he didn't know where he was going to go with the onslaught of punk and how he was going to react to it.
All right, so now I took the easy way out. I took the acoustic side. You have got the electric side, which means you have the dilemma of all time for any Neil Young fan. What is Powderfinger about?
Well, it's a song you could write a novel about, right? And in fact, if you go online, there are incredible dissertations on what this song means to people. And the beauty of it is that it can mean something different to everyone. But one thing that is known about this song, it is an indisputable fact, is that it began from one line. Neil had the opening line in his head and wrote the song around it eventually. Look out, mama, there's a white boat coming up the river. And suddenly that opens up a novel's worth of ideas about where you could be and who this narrator is and what the song could be about. He'd worked on the song basically since the late 60s. Apparently that line popped into his head in the late 60s, apparently finished it in 75, and started touring it on this particular series of shows where it really came together with Crazy Horse. Now, the song can be interpreted many, many different ways. Some people see it as a Wild West John Ford type movie scenario. Let's go back to the 19th century. Civil War scenario, if you will.
Yeah.
The big white boat coming around the turn. Is this some Union army coming after the Confederates on the river?
It's the Federals. I'm protecting my still, and they're coming to take my whiskey.
The white boat implies an authority figure of some sort, whether it's an army or maybe it's the Coast Guard, but they're coming after you. The sense I get from listening to the song is that it's less of an organized force that they're after, but, as you said, some outlaws. Yeah, and it could have been some moonshine going on, some illegal activity, some contraband that is being created. You never really know.
Some white powder that was popular in the disco yeah, era.
Exactly. But yet again, how does that explain the setting? It could be, you almost get the sense of the Civil War kind of thing at the same time. So as with Pocahontas, He's flipping through time. He's melding together the centuries. You don't know if you're in the 20th century. You don't know if you're in the 19th century. You could be anywhere. But the main point is that we have these authority figures, these people with more guns and more ammo than you could ever possibly imagine coming after you. And how are you going to react in this crucible? He's just turned 22, he tells us in the song. These people are coming to get me. They're probably not here to shake hands and say, come on in, we'll have a little chat. No, they're here to wipe us out. So I have to act somehow. He reacts by picking up a gun and aiming it at the boat, instead finds himself, his face splashes in the sky before he can even get a shot off. And in the last verse, he's talking to us from the grave. Think of me as one you'd never figure would fade away so young, with so much left undone. Again, the themes of the album being tied together, the whole idea of rust never sleeps, burning out before you can fade away, an early death, is that preferable to being around for decades longer and perhaps living not quite so fulfilling a life and instead dying, doing the one thing that kind of makes you a hero. In this case, defending your family and its way of life. And then you've got this riff. And I think it is one of the all-time great Neil Young riffs. Majestic and tragic all at once, the way it ascends and then hits those doomy chords on the way down. You can see the whole character's life in that riff. Crazy Horse falling in around it. A great performance, and also perhaps the most lyrical Young solo on this record. I mean, the rest of it is just like violent thudding. And here you have this almost elegiac quality. It leads off the electric half, and the electric half of the album just becomes more violent. The death that he leaves you with at the end of this song is definitely played out, I think, in Hey Hey My My Into the Black at the end, where he just blows everything apart. This is a death sonically that is talked about in the song Powderfinger initially. So let's hear it. Powderfinger from Neil Young on Sound Opinions.
Look out, mama, there's a white boat coming up the river with a big red beacon and a flag and a man on the rail. I think you better call John, 'cause it don't look like they're here to deliver the mail, and it's less than a
That is Powderfinger by Neil Young from 1979, wrapping up our classic album dissection of Rust Never Sleeps. Now we want to hear from you. On this 40th anniversary, do you think Rust Never Sleeps still holds up as a great album? Call 888-859-1800, leave us a message with your take, and tell us why. Coming up, we talk about the iconic Rickenbacker 12-string guitar. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, he's Jim DeRogatis, and this week is the first of the Sound Opinions Summer School. Earlier in the show, we discussed Neil Young's Rust Never Sleeps on its 40th anniversary, and now we're going to turn to an iconic and important instrument in rock music.
The electric 12-string guitar, particularly the Rickenbacker electric 12-string. We asked Daniel Escarissa and Shelby Pollard from Chicago Music Exchange to come in and help demonstrate this particular sound.
So what is a 12-string guitar? I mean, it's obviously twice as many strings as your typical 6-string guitar. That much is obvious.
Very Spinal Tap. Goes up to 11.
Yeah, and I think some people may get the impression like it takes a, you know, you got to need 20 fingers to play that thing. There's more strings.
Yeah,
but it's really not that complicated. The instrument has 6 pairs of strings that are pretty close together. Here's Daniel explaining that.
You can kind of approach it physically in a similar way and play it very similarly that you would a 6-string, except when you're plucking or strumming or hitting a string, you're hitting 2 at the same time, and they're either tuned in unison, so it's playing the same note, or it's playing the same note an octave apart. And the result is kind of a jingly chorusing effect. You can really hear these differences if we isolate them. So here's Shelby playing an E chord on a 6-string guitar. And here he is playing the same E chord on a 12-string.
The concept of striking 2 strings at once while fretting a note goes back centuries to double-stringed instruments like the mandolin, the lute, the charango, and the oud.
The modern acoustic 12-string guitar came to America at the end of the 19th century, but it was the legendary blues guitarist Lead Belly who popularized it in the 30s and 40s. The first attempt to make an electric version of the 12-string was a bizarre double-neck guitar with an unusual tuning called the Stratosphere Twin, made by a small company in Missouri in 1954. The Stratosphere was taken up briefly by the country virtuosos Chet Atkins and Jimmy Bryant, but otherwise nobody was really interested in it. But a change came in the early 60s when songs by artists like Pete Seeger and the Rooftop Singers became hits. Here's Daniel from Chicago Music Exchange again.
Folk music all of a sudden became very popular, right, and hip. And the 12-string acoustic guitar is a major component in that music. Walk right in, set right down. Baby, let your hair hang down. As bands were getting bigger and bigger and louder, in live situations, people just could not hear the guitar anymore. And the need to electrify these instruments was very real.
A manufacturer in California saw an opportunity for electric 12 strings to actually catch on this time. The Rickenbacker Company had been experimenting with electrifying string instruments for a long time.
Rickenbacker was founded in 1931 and really focused on Hawaiian instruments like steel guitars, tenor guitars, ukuleles, mandolins.
They even built an electric harp for Harpo Marx. They built prototypes of an electric 12-string in 1963, and they made a very shrewd marketing move when they heard that a buzzabout British band was coming to town for the first time.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
They found out that the Beatles were going to be in the United States to play at the famous Ed Sullivan show that changed everything. And the higher-ups in Rickenbacker made sure that one of these prototypes made it to the hands of the Beatles. George Harrison got the gift. He was totally enamored with the instrument, famously heard on that opening chord of A Hard Day's Night.
It's been a hard day's night. Shelby Pollard from the Chicago Music Exchange says that iconic sound could only have been accomplished on a 12-string.
Has this great jangle to it that you wouldn't be able to get from a 6-string guitar. On a 6-string, it just sounds like you're playing a combobulation of wrong notes. It just sounds flat and strange.
And it also plays prominently in the solo of the song as well.
Cause when I get you alone, you know I'll be here.
After Hard Day's Night came out in 1964, everybody wanted a Rickenbacker 12-string. Other British invasion bands like Jerry and the Pacemakers quickly picked up their own. You can hear it all over the early singles by The Who. And in America, a guitar player named Jim, later Roger McGuinn, went to see the movie A Hard Day's Night many times, just so he could figure out what instrument George Harrison was playing. He bought his own Rickenbacker 12-string and brought it to the band The Birds and used it all over their first single, Mr. Tambourine Man. Here's Shelby playing that riff so you can hear the Rick in isolation.
And here it is on 6th string. You can see it's a lot simpler, much less complex in sound.
The Rick 12-string defined the Byrds sound at the time, and the folk rock movement in general. Along with the Beatles, they set the template for the way other bands in the 60s would use electric 12-strings, from the Beach Boys to the Turtles to Jefferson Airplane. Even when bands didn't actually have a Rickenbacker 12-string, they wanted to emulate that sound by playing two guitars at once.
But the Rickenbacker 12-string had a unique sound that could never be fully imitated. Here's Daniel again with the technical explanation.
One of the things that gives the Rickenbacker its distinct sound, other than it being a semi-hollow body guitar, meaning that it's not a solid piece of wood, the toaster pickups that Rickenbacker was so famous for had a very different sound than the thinner sounding single coils.
Plus, the Rickenbacker's got an unmistakable look. I mean, Jim, picture that fire glow guitar on the iconic cover to Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty. I mean, Petty's used it on many of his classic songs. Here's Shelby again playing a little of Tom Petty's hit, The Waiting, so you can hear that Rick 12-string by itself.
Tom Petty wasn't the only 60s-inspired act to use 12-strings in the 70s. The Rick defined the sound of the power pop bands who modeled themselves on the Beatles, the Byrds, and the Who. Bands like Big Star and the Raspberries. Power pop scene evolved in the 80s into a new breed of college rock bands with similar sensibilities. R.E.M., Let's Active, The Bangles, The Smiths, The Smithereens, The Rain Parade, The 3 O'Clock, all of them used 12 strings extensively. The characteristic sound of Rickenbacker 12 strings even gave the subgenre its name, Jangle Pop. You can go all the way back to Jingle Jangle Morning from Mr. Tambourine Man for the roots of that.
All these bands are basically referencing Beatlesque guitar pop. That is the source of a lot of this music, and it still continues today. We're seeing these 60s influences pop up in contemporary artists using 12 strings, that nostalgic vibe that they want. I'm thinking about artists like Kurt Vile, the band Temples, Michael Cronin. But you do not see examples of this in other genres. You don't see it as much in funk, soul, and punk.
Well, Greg, I mean, you know, I think that there's twice as many strings, so punk musicians are, you know, against having to tune twice as many strings. Plus, you know, these don't sound good, 12 strings through the wah-wah pedal or the fuzz box. This is an instrument that inherently is meant to jangle. It doesn't even do the traditional guitar leads very well. You can find the occasional solo out there played on a 12-string Rick, but you do not hear a lot of shredding on one of these instruments. We asked Shelby from Chicago Music Exchange about the physical limitations keeping 12 strings from being lead instruments.
You're cramming twice the amount of strings into the same amount of fretboard, so it does become a little bit more difficult to play. It's very difficult to do bends or play extensive leads on the instrument. You're doubling the amount of string tension that you need to be able to bend and manipulate to play leads on. I can't even get my fingers in there. So hard, I can't do it. Can't even get it up to the note. Like, that's not a full step.
You know, knowing how hard it is to play this instrument, when you do hear an impressive 12-string guitar solo, you pay attention to it. I'm thinking about Steve Howe of the band Yes, specifically on the song Awaken. That's a 12-string Rick on that song, and that is the core of that particular piece. It's the long extended piece of music on the Going for the One album that Yes made in 1977. It's about 15 minutes long. That riff that Howe plays on the Rick is the core of that song. Now, that started out as an instrumental that he was thinking might be worthy of one of his solo releases. He wasn't thinking about it as a Yes song, per se. The story goes that he was playing that riff over and over in the hotel room, and John Anderson, the vocalist of Yes, was wandering by and going, "What is that? You've been playing that for about 6 hours.
Yeah.
I like that. Can we do something with that?" So the story goes that Anderson conceived some lyrics over that riff, and lo and behold, it became this epic track on the Yes album. It's got an Eastern kind of sound, Jim. It's a very unique sounding solo in the lexicon, not only of Yes, but of the 12-string guitar, I think. So here's a little bit of Steve Howe soloing on that 12-string Rickenbacker on Yes's Awaken on Sound Opinions.
I love that you played Yes, Greg, on Sound Opinions. I love that Going for the One album. Progressive rock is one of the non-jangly genres that has used the Rickenbacker 12-string well. I'm going to go back to that Beatles thing in the sense that XTC always was a Beatlesque pop band, albeit a very, very ambitious one, taking off from Revolver. 1982, their fifth studio album, English Settlement, an ambitious double album release in the UK in its original form, was inspired by two instruments. Dave Gregory, sort of the jack-of-all-trades instrumentalist of XTC, he had recently scored two new instruments, a Prophet 5 synthesizer and a Rickenbacker 12-string. That sound is on almost every song on English Settlement. And I think Gregory put it well when he was talking about the song All of a Sudden It's Too Late. It was XTC's first real love song, he said. And he said the Rick 12 had a melancholy timbre that worked perfectly. Plangent was the word bandied about at the time. The fact that XTC would use a word like plangent, you know, they were always a little too smart for their own good. But he's right. That's exactly what this sounds like. I love this album. I think the Rick 12-string makes it. Listen for it here. All of a Sudden, It's Too Late by XTC on Sound Opinions.
All of a sudden, It's Too Late from XTC, a great example of a 12-string Rickenbacker in action. Now let's put it to our listeners. What's your favorite use of a Rickenbacker 12-string? Can you think of a great electric 12-string song outside that jangly pop genre? Leave us a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Greg, what's on the show next week?
The next installment in our Sound Opinions Summer School series, a classic album dissection of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
Download or stream Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcasts. The show was produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, Iona Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Hi, this is Bob from Shawnee, Kansas. I really enjoyed your show on the best of 2019 so far. My album of the year thus far is by a guy that called himself Apex Manor. The album is called Heartbreak City. To me, it sounds like early Pete Yorn, some of the stuff that he did early in his career, crunchy guitars, great driving rhythm, but still very melodic, nice mix of all-out rockers with some kind of touching ballads as well. I think he has a pretty bright future ahead of him. Thanks.
My name's Ted. I really enjoyed the songs that changed your life. I did want to make a note that in the late 80s, I was sitting in a crappy job, and I was dead-ending, and I'd given up music, and then in succession, I bought REM's Document, the Meat Puppets, Huevos, and the Replacements, Pleased to Meet Me. And a year later, I was in a band, and a year and a half later, I was divorced. And it worked out okay. Anyway, I really enjoyed the show. Thanks.
Yeah, you were talking about songs that have shaped our lives. And I just had to call in and share a song that has done the most to shape, and I mean literally shape as in a physical sense, my life, is Break On Through to the Other Side. It's been my weight loss journey theme song the past 3 years of losing and keeping off 90 pounds. Break On Through inspired me to break past every weight loss milestone I set for myself. So yeah, it became something of my personal battle cry.
Break On Through to the Other Side. Yeah.
Long live Jim Morrison and long live the Doors. So grateful for him.
We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can't you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
Andrew from Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. And I just listened to your episode of what songs, what music defined you. In 2004, I was shown or introduced to, you know, Alice in Chains, particularly the Unplugged album. It was absolutely life-changing for me because Layne Staley was having a rough go at the time, obviously, but it was so beautifully done. It was such an incredibly well-done Unplugged performance that it really made me realize that, you know, even through hard times, that music is a beautiful expression.
Ain't found a way to kill me yet. Eyes burn with sting and sweat. Seems every path leads
I really love your show. It was awesome. Keep killing it, guys. You're awesome. Thanks.
Wife and kids, household pet, army green.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.